From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics Amy Nicholson and Claudia Puig review Spike Lee's new movie, The Five Bloods. We're listening to its soundtrack from composer Terrence Blanchard. Lee's film tells the story of five veterans of Vietnam who go back to the country years later to search for the remains of their squad leader. Also this week, The King of Staten Island. It stars and is co-written by Saturday Night Live's Pete Davidson. Judd Apatow directs and co-wrote. The movie's partly based on Davidson's life experiences. Disney's Artemis Fowl is a family film based on a popular series of novels. Young Ferdia Shaw stars, Kenneth Branagh directs. It's Film Week on KPCC. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us, with film critics Claudia Puig, the president of the L.A. Film Critics Association, and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. We begin this week with a brand new movie from Judd Apatow. He not only directs but co-wrote the film with its star Pete Davidson. It's based on incidents in Davidson's own life. Marissa Tomei co-stars in The King of Staten Island. Amy?
Yeah, Judd Apatow's comedy template for the last decade or so has been, you know, pick a rising comic who just has radioactive amounts of talent and take their whole comedy persona and sort of shoehorn it into a semi-autobiographical story where they get to really heal their problems, you know, usually through love, kind of like what he did with Amy Schumer a few years ago in Trainwreck. And it's interesting who he's picked. You know, his star of the new one, who helps write it, of course, is Pete Davidson, who people might be able to picture as like the heavily tattooed, skinny guy who became one of SNL's youngest cast in the show when he was 20 years old. And this is his loosely autobiographical story. It's the story of a kid like him, who's kind of a screw up, whose dad is a firefighter who died when he was young, and who is, you know, battling with some mental health challenges, and he's scared of himself. He doesn't think that he's completely stable, and he smokes too much weed, and he's a giant screw-up. And so this is a movie kind of about who he would be if he hadn't fallen into comedy, if he hadn't, you know, set sort of a template of his own by being one of the youngest members of Saturday Night Live when he was 20 years old. And it's interesting because you can feel kind of a tension in this film. You know, Judd Apatow wants to make this a happy ending. You know, he wants to like have him mature and grow up and put this kind of sweet, sugary spin on things. But Pete Davidson is kind of a better comedian than that. I mean, this is really a great selling point movie for Pete Davidson as a leading man. I mean, he's really charismatic. He's really funny. And he's not a comedian that I think can get shoehorned into an easy answer, happy kind of comedy the way that Judd Apatow wants to do. And so there's a really kind of fascinating push-pull in the center of this, where Pete Davidson almost breaks out of the Judd Apatow template and makes a movie that feels interesting on its own.
The King of Staten Island, new film we're talking about. Claudia, what did you think?
Well, I agree with Amy. I think Pete Davidson is very charismatic. And he also has this kind of sweetness and vulnerability, along with kind of this edginess and even, a tad of like something obnoxious but sort of likable. So he's appealing. And he has this very expressive face. And, you know, we have known about his public persona and his pain and his emotional trauma. So I think that helps in some way inform this film. But I feel like in some ways it's kind of light. And it kind of, you know, struggles to become a bromance. And I feel like it's not terribly effective in that way. But I think, you know, I think Amy brings up a really good point. I think that maybe he doesn't fit into this structure in the same way that Seth Rogen or some of the other people that Judd Apatow has worked with to sort of fit into this template. And I don't feel like this is like lightning in a bottle magic that some of his other films have been. You know, they've been kind of cultural touchstones, like this 40-Year-Old Virgin. But I don't feel like it's as good as Funny People, which is maybe one of his more nuanced and complex films. But I, you know, it's enjoyable. It's a little too long. It's 135 minutes. That's too long. There's some other good performances, but it's, you know, it does certainly show that Pete Davidson can be a star.
We're talking about the comedic drama The King of Staten Island, starring Pete Davidson, who co-wrote it with the director Judd Apatow. The film's rated R, and you can see it in just about every on-demand platform imaginable. Defy Bloods is the new Spike Lee film. Lee co-wrote it, directed it. Delroy Lindo, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. star. Claudia.
Well, this movie could not be more timely and relevant. It feels almost prophetic coming, as it is right now in the midst of the uprisings that are going on and, post George Floyd's killing. So it's landed at the perfect time. And many of us are expressly looking for films about the Black experience, just as we're looking for, things to read about the Black experience. So this, navigates this inflection point. And it also deals with systemic racism, but it is a look at the Vietnam War from a Black perspective. And, in the way that Spike Lee can kind of bring in the past and give you kind of a history lesson in an entertaining way, I think it succeeds that way. And he brings up the fact that only 11% of the U.S. population are African American, but in Vietnam, they represented 33% of the troops. So that right there is, one inequity. And then I think it's, then he goes into this story. It's kind of it flashes back and forward. We see these four guys who had been brothers together in Vietnam, and they go back to reclaim their commander's remains and also to find a treasure that they consider sort of reparations. It's a continuing reminder that he's a really vital filmmaker, and it's a strong follow-up to Black Klansman, which won the Best Adapted Screenplay last year, 2019. I like that it's illuminating, fascinating. It's not didactic. There's some fantastic performances. Delroy Lindo is excellent. Chadwick Boseman and Jonathan Majors, who is in Last Black Man in San Francisco as Delroy Lindo's son. And it covers so many issues that are Black trauma, police violence, American imperialism. They have some references to Donald Trump as the president of fake bone spurs, and MAGA hat is kind of a quasi-cursed talisman. So it's very timely.
Defy Bloods from Spike Lee. Amy.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating film. It's almost more interesting to talk about after the fact than it is to watch it, if that makes sense. Because when you watch it from scene to scene, it's a film that has so much of the Spike Lee energy that it doesn't really feel like it coheres from scene to scene. And it kind of shifts from a comedy to, very strongly hat-tipping itself to films like Treasure of the Sierra Madre, to Apocalypse Now, to the point where a character says, to the camera, madness, madness. And, watching it, I was sort of a little befuddled and trying to put it all together into a coherent story. And then when you take a step back, it really feels like this is a film where Spike Lee is being so obvious in the films that he's making, tipping his hat to, that it passes through homage and turns almost into a statement about ownership, saying this is my epic, this is my version of Apocalypse Now, and why haven't we had the Black experience told in its version of Apocalypse Now in the past? And it feels kind of like reclaiming almost Hollywood myths in the way. Like, he's very detailed. There's even a character played by Jean Reno who shows up dressed like Belloc from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so it feels like within this story that, teeters from Wild Hogs to Apocalypse Now, you're also talking about the legacy of the stories that have been put onto film and kind of putting your own stamp on that. And I have to absolutely agree with Claudia. Delroy Lindo is fascinating. I mean, he's really, he's just so compelling in this. He gives a few monologues straight to camera where you almost can't breathe because it's so tense and scary and powerful.
He's always a powerful presence, whether it's film or television. We're talking about, charisma, Pete Davidson in the last film. Lindo, to me, is one of those actors who just, he has so much presence on screen.
Absolutely.
And what's interesting, too, about the way that Spike Lee does it is he gives you extra Delroy Lindo, because even though this film does take place in the past a lot, he uses the same actors, the older actors, in the flashbacks. So they're just showing up as their older versions of themselves, reliving their past. And I think there's interesting things to pull apart in how you don't get to move forward, how you're kind of the same person you are. But also, it is true that Delroy Lindo is so compelling in this film that the other characters fall to the side a bit.
To Five Bloods from director and co-screenwriter Spike Lee, Delroy Lindo, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. star. The film's rated R and it's streaming on Netflix. The family fantasy adventure Artemis Fowl stars Ferdia Shaw, Lara McDonald, and Josh Gad. Kenneth Branagh directs the film. Connor McPherson and Hamish McCall are the screenwriters. Amy?
Yeah, this is just another gigantic, focus-tested to death, splashy kids effects, kids special effects movie. It just feels like very test-marketed to death and very weak and kind of a flop. The story here is that Artemis Fowl is a genius, and his father, played by Colin Farrell, is kind of a historian and also possibly a criminal, and he disappears. And as Artemis is a kid, his dad is always telling him about the history of goblins and dwarves and fairies. He's a magical expert and sort of an Irish historian of fantasy as well. And so he's trained his super genius kid to know everything about this underground fairy magical world. And then his dad is himself kidnapped, and Artemis Fowl has to do one of those boring old stories where he has to find a magical doohickey to save the planet, and everybody's running after to get the magical doohickey back. I mean, it's a strange movie, because what's happening in the fairy underground is that you have all these like fairy policemen. Judi Dench is the chief of the fairy cops. There's a younger kid who's also like a fairy cop that Artemis Fowl has to deal with. I mean, it's almost like if Harry Potter was about policemen. And it's just, I mean, it's weird. It feels like the longest movie on earth because you don't go anywhere. Most of the action just takes place inside of Artemis Fowl's magical house. And then it's told with this narration flashback from Josh Gad as this tall dwarf who wishes he was shorter, who's been arrested by the police at the very beginning. It's almost like they're trying to do, you know, a Kaiser Soze kind of flashback with Josh Gad. I mean, I guess if you have kids, this will kill 90 minutes. It's very hard to sit through. it's wild to me that there's films that supposedly have all this imagination and yet feel just as trite and rote as everything else in the Disney canon lately.
Artemis Fowl is streaming on Disney Plus. It's rated PG, based on the novel by Owen Colfer. Artemis Fowl, Kenneth Branagh, the director. The Surrogate, a drama, stars Jasmine Batchelor, Chris Perfetti, and Sullivan Jones. It's written and directed by Jeremy Hirsch in a feature writing and directing debut. Claudia, what'd you think of The Surrogate?
I like this film. It's a small, kind of micro-budgeted film, and it's really all about the performance of Jasmine Batchelor as Jess, and it's just wonderfully anchored by her performance. It's very naturalistic. The film is about a woman who agrees to be a surrogate for her best friend, who is gay, and his husband, and then a prenatal test comes back, and the results are unexpected, and it kind of brings up some moral dilemmas for all involved, and particularly for the woman who is the surrogate. So she goes through, you know, every possibility, thinking about the best course of action, and she really goes through it thoroughly, and I love that it's never moralistic. It just looks at all the angles and all the ramifications of a pregnancy where you learn there could be unexpected conditions. There's no histrionics. There's no preaching. It's perceptive. It's absorbing. You know, there are no easy answers here, no easy right or wrong answers, and they don't try to make it easy. And it kind of surprises you along the way, which is great. And she is this kind of person who's always trying to please, and which is probably why she agrees to do it in the first place. Not that many people might, but, you know, because she is this accommodating person, you sort of see how she evolves into somebody who is more herself and kind of comes into her own. And, she just has this lived in performance. It's great. I think the ensemble cast is really good. You see her growth as a character. I just love the unexpected directions and the lack of easy answers about this film. I think it's really quite good.
The Surrogate, the film Claudia is telling us about. Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, it is absolutely a terrific debut from Jeremy Hirsch. And Jasmine Batchelor, who plays the lead, is fantastic. I mean, this character is a really interesting portrait of the kind of optimistic do-gooding that can wind up causing a lot of problems as well. You know, Jess is so interesting. She's a person who shows up with the reusable water bottle. She's got the job at the nonprofit. And her selflessness does also come with kind of a self-righteous streak. You know, she's very idealistic. And expects a lot out of people and expects a lot of herself. I like movies like this where everyone involved is a good person and they're attempting to be a good communicator. And when you listen to the way they talk to each other, you know, there's more apologies for inadvertent microaggressions than there are like arguments between the characters. They're all trying to work this out. And it's also worth noting that Jess is upper middle class and she's Black, and that factors into when she has difficult conversations with her mother. You know, they have a really tricky conversation about her family raised her to break stereotypes about single motherhood. And so that adds this whole other dimension to the film, if it comes to single motherhood. So I really appreciate this film. And you also do have some, you get to spend some time with some Down syndrome children here as actors, including a really adorable boy named Leon, who just is the cutest thing on the planet.
All right, the film is The Surrogate, starring Jasmine Bachelor. It's directed and written by Jeremy Hirsch. The film's unrated. It's available on Vimeo, the on-demand platform, as well as Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. It's unrated. Coming up, we'll hear about Sometimes, Always, Never and the short history of The Long Road. It's Film Week on KPCC. Great to have you with us for Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, kpcc.org, and of course, it's a podcast and a highly popular one. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Film Week. I'm joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson of The Guardian and the podcast Unspooled, and Claudia Puig, who's the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Our next film up is a British comedic drama, Sometimes, Always, Never. It's directed by Carl Hunter. Frank Cottrell Boyce is the screenwriter, and it stars Bill Nighy, Sam Riley, and Alice Lowe. Amy, Sometimes, Always, Never.
Yeah, this is a really jewel box indie dramedy portrait of a father and a son. One of those kind of comedies that teeters right on the edge of being dark and irredeemable and bitter and funny. The story here is that Bill Nighy and his son, Sam Riley, are really grappling with the fact that Sam Riley's brother, Bill Nighy's son, has disappeared and they don't know what happened to him and they're trying to find him. And the film opens with them going on this tiny road trip of sorts to see a body that's been found and discover if it's theirs. The way it is about how these two people really aren't processing their emotions and communicating. And the way that they do communicate is through Scrabble. So this film is incredibly Scrabble obsessed. And if you are looking for a film that interjects stories about fathers and sons with debates about whether XI is a letter or a word, you know, the words like music that just keep coming up with gigantic high Scrabble counts. And kind of the drama is that, you know, here are people who are so good with words and good at using them and summing them up, but they are not able to talk at all. And they tend to disappear when things get uncomfortable. And these men of the family are all trying to use their intelligence as a way to dominate conversations and win over people and win over women. And you know, it's an enjoyable film. It feels kind of slight in action, but Bill Nighy himself, I mean, he's so good at skating on that edge of being a person that you hate as much as you want him to like you. And that's happening very strongly here.
Sometimes, Always, Never, Claudia.
Yeah, I think Alan is his character. Bill Nighy's character, he's the only person that could ever play this role. I mean, you believe him as this dapper tailor. You know, he is acerbic, but he's also, you feel his dignity underlying and also his regret and his grief. Because there's a lot of, you know, while there is the whole Scrabble thing, and I learned some new words, which I'm very happy about. And, you know, you have the sort of offbeat aspects. You also have this underlying undercurrent of heartache and grief and healing. And but there's at the same time, you have this visual cuteness that sort of feels like an Anglo-Saxon Amelie with a touch of Wes Anderson sort of sprinkled in. There's this, you know, vivid, eye-catching, very color-drenched style. And then there's these sort of stylized chapters, you know, that we've seen before, and conversations that are kind of filmed through archways and then, you know, painted backdrops. So it has a stylized kind of low-key eccentricity. And, of course, Bill Nighy also sort of embodies sort of British low-key eccentricity. So, you know, that all works. And even the premise is sort of offbeat. I mean, the two, they were all playing Scrabble, and the two sons and the father argued over the legitimacy of the word "zoe," you know, which is very boring in Scrabble, and the son stormed off and never came back. So, you know, there's an offbeat aspect, but also a lot more depth there. And again, Nighy is just fantastic as this controlling and kind of bitingly witty guy who also, you know, kind of uses words to hide behind and also to sort of control, but at the same time you see sort of his emotions come through. And the rest of the performances are also really quite good. I mean, it's Bill Nighy's movie, but Sam Riley, who plays the son, has a lot more notes than just kind of the son that is still around. You know, he could just play, it could have been a one-note resentful kind of son, and it's more than that. So I think the script is also something to note. And then Jenny Agutter, it's nice to see her come back, and Tim McInerney have smaller parts. And I think it works. I mean, it's slight, but it's you know, it, particularly for people who enjoy British, you know, drama comedies, and how can you not love Bill Nighy?
Sometimes, Always, Never, directed by Carl Hunter, Frank Cottrell Boyce wrote the screenplay. It's rated PG-13, Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema to see the film. The short history of The Long Road, a drama starring Sabrina Carpenter, Stephen Ogg, and Danny Trejo. It's written and directed by Ani Simon Kennedy. Claudia?
Well, this is a little gem of a movie. It's played a lot of film festivals, and I think it won a special jury award at Tribeca a couple years ago, 2019. I guess that would be just last year. And it's a kind of a simple story about a teenager who grows up with her father living out of a van, basically. They're like these nomadic father and daughter, and not because he is a loser, but more because this is kind of his philosophical approach to life, and he thinks that, you know, it's not really kind of homelessness. It's more like this is what he, the life he wants to have, a life on the open road, and so they crisscross the United States, and he feels like this, he's giving her the best possible education. She goes to libraries. He makes ends meet by being a kind of a fix-it guy, a handyman, and he relishes their independence. I'm not sure she relishes it quite as much, but something happens, and their rootlessness has, something changes everything. I don't want to give it too much away. But suddenly she is kind of cast onto her own, and so I wish it had explored homelessness a little bit more and what it's like to be sort of a teenager in this situation. It didn't quite do that. There's some wonderful lines, though, like the father will say things as, after he fixes somebody's sink. He'll say, you know, humans are a migratory species, and we're going back to our roots, and society will be, you know, better off once we build an army of self-sufficient agitators. And, you know, he's very anti-TV. He tells her to look out her window, and she has, you know, it's like a TV screen there. So I think there's some really nice moments. It's a coming-of-age film, and then it has this great performance by Danny Trejo, who's runs a garage, and they kind of bond. And then a Native American actress named Jeshuan St. John, who's also quite good. And Stephen Ogg, who plays the father, is excellent. He reminds me a little bit of kind of Peter Fonda. Maybe it's because he's on the open road. But Sabrina Carpenter as the lead actress is quite good. It's a very nice little small movie that has something to say about coming of age and about, you know, how you can educate yourself in ways other than the traditional schooling.
The short history of The Long Road, a drama written and directed by Ani Simon Kennedy in her feature directing debut. The movie's unrated. It's available starting Tuesday of next week on iTunes. Infamous stars Bella Thorne and Jake Manley. It's written and directed by Joshua Caldwell, a crime drama. Amy?
Yeah, this is the kind of movie we get every generation or so. It's the Bonnie and Clyde of this generation. We've actually already had a few of them recently this year. You know, we had Queen and Slim last year, and this is the Instagram version of that, where Instagram is to blame for everything. The story here is that Bella Thorne is from what she calls the Redneck Riviera of Florida, and she's this bored and beautiful and heavily tattooed girl who just wants to be famous, and she's from a family with really zero options. You know, her mom's not really there, and her mom just rotates in a series of bad boyfriends, one in particular who's there. And so when she sees this kind of blonde bad boy mechanic played by Jake Manley, who shows up in town, she seizes on this. She's like, we need to leave town. We are going to support ourselves robbing weed dispensaries as we make our way to California. And she wants to get famous. And she tries to convince him that if she Instagrams all of their robberies, that's great. And he is a little bit more logical. He's sensible, if you can be a sensible robber, and a sensible ex-con, saying, you know, this is a terrible idea. The cops are going to get us. And that's pretty much the argument of the film, you know? It's interesting. You know, we keep getting these stories of, like, thrill-seeking young lovers, and they don't really change as much as they just reflect what we think is the problem with the kids these days. And so here it feels like, you know, it's a very thin fable, and that the lesson's obvious from the beginning. You know, getting online fame means nothing compared to your life if you're not standing for something in particular. But yet, you know, as much as I rolled my eyes at a lot of these films, I do have to say, you know, Bella Thorne is very committed to the part, and I like her in the part. And I really think that Jake Manley has an integrity to this film that makes it a stronger film than I think it had to be. You know, he has this bleached hair and stubble. He kind of looks like a 90s Brad Pitt style, you know, that kind of dirty, greasy, shocking look. And so I appreciate this film more than I thought. It was revolutionary at all.
We're talking about the drama, crime drama, Infamous, Claudia.
Yeah, I would say it definitely wasn't revolutionary. You know, it's so true. We have Bonnie and Clyde, Natural Born Killers. But I feel like this isn't not nearly as thought-provoking. And then Amy mentioned Queen and Slim, which I thought was exploring far more intriguing territory. In contrast to, you know, a movie like The Five Bloods, this could, you know, which is so perfectly timed, this feels off timing-wise. Not only is it a thin story, but it's trying to make this statement about social media and young people's obsession with it and empty-headed teens. But we're actually at a time right now where young people are using their voice for positive change. And so I feel like it's the timing is really off. It doesn't feel like it's of this moment. It's coming off as a kind of this lightweight indictment of a generation that kind of does care about things. I mean, they do care about equality and climate change. And so, you know, yes, there are certainly plenty of people who probably care about mindless likes and followers. And, you know, they eventually get millions of people following them in their crime escapade, but it feels like a little too late in terms of a commentary. But I do agree that Bella Thorne is very committed to the part, and Jake Manley, who's named Dean, and he's playing kind of a James Dean role, you know, he does a good job. He is a sort of bleach blonde guy who seems to have a jot more sense than she does. But, you know, we know no good is ever going to come of it. As we're watching, we know that eventually they're either going to be caught or, you know, they're going to be killed, one or the other. We know that they're not just going to get away with this. They're not particularly likable. They're not all that well-developed. I think performances are as good as they can possibly be, given the limitations of the script.
Infamous is the film, Bella Thorne, Jake Manley. It's unrated, and it's at drive-ins. You can actually see it at a theater, including the Mission Tiki, the Vineland, and the Van Buren. And it's available for at-home viewing on iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, and Fandango now. Infamous is unrated. 2 Minutes of Fame, a comedy starring Jay Farrow and Cat Williams, Leslie Small directed, Devon Shepard and Yamara Taylor are the screenwriters. Amy?
Yeah, we actually have two comedies this week starring SNL people. This one here is starring Jay Farrow as a young comedian, aspiring comedian, really, who's working at a grocery store and wants to leave Birmingham, Alabama, where he has a wife and a kid, for this comedy contest in Los Angeles with his best friend, who's sort of his mentor. And there's a few competing forces happening here. You know, one, this is a story about, like, people who have made it and haven't made it. You know, he's competing online, making mean videos about a major black comedian who's played by Cat Williams, who he thinks has sold out a lot. He makes films where he, for example, plays a black crow. And so there's this internet war between the two of them. You know, Jay making videos about how Cat Williams' comedies are a disgrace, Cat Williams fighting back and saying, like, you're just an Instagram comedian. You don't even know the training that people like me went through. You weren't there in the 90s working your way up, getting mentorship. And I think that dynamic is pretty interesting. And I think Jay Farrow himself, I mean, he's a terrific mimic. I mean, he does impressions all the way throughout this film. Tracy Morgan, Kevin Hart, Jay-Z, Eddie Murphy, Obama. They are amazing impressions. But yet the character himself that he's playing is kind of the worst. You know, Kiki Palmer is his wife, and everything she says about, like, what are you doing? You're half on her side. And when he, the kind of comedy he writes, the kind of comedy he performs is not that great. And so it's hard to root for this guy to succeed. I think the film, you know, sets up a lot of interesting questions and then just kind of softballs it with a happy ending.
2 Minutes of Fame comedy starring Jay Farrow and Cat Williams. Leslie Small directs. It's rated R and available starting next Tuesday, streaming on iTunes. And we've got just about a minute or so to talk about the French drama Aviva, the film written and directed by Boaz Yakin. Claudia, what'd you think?
Well, I think it's intriguing. It's somewhat flawed, but I think it's fluid movie in a lot of ways, fluid in body movements, fluid in its definition of gender and love. It's a dance movie, and it's sexy, and it's often daring. There's a lot of it's impressionistic, and it's the gender fluidity is probably the most interesting aspect. These two characters who fall in love, and they're played by four different people, and it alternates between male and female actors playing them. So it's trying to capture the complexity of relationships and the fluidity of genders. And there's some beautiful dance sequences. It's choreography from a former member of the Israeli dance company, Bat Shiva Dance Company. So I think there's some. I feel like the love story is not nearly as interesting. I feel like it's more pedestrian, but the dance and of course the exploration of gender is more intriguing.
Aviva is the film starring Bobby Janae Smith, written and directed by Boaz Yakin. It's unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. Coming up, The Frame's John Horn interviews writer, director, producer Judd Apatow. They'll be talking about the new film, The King of Staten Island, a film that brings to the forefront Saturday Night Live performer Pete Davidson. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Director, writer, producer Judd Apatow has the new film, The King of Staten Island, on video on demand this week. Earlier on Film Week, our critics reviewed it. Pete Davidson stars as an aspiring tattoo artist forced to deal with the childhood trauma from the death of his father, a New York City firefighter. When Davidson's widowed mother starts dating another firefighter, it brings it to the fore. The film was slated for a theatrical release, but has moved up because of COVID-19 theater closures. The Frame host, John Horn, called up Apatow and asked him about the filmmaking team and the studio, what the conversations were like about getting it released now.
I mean, for us, it's a very simple conversation. You know, we can release it in the very distant future and release it in the middle of a pileup of an enormous amount of movies that have been pushed into the future. Or we can release it on video on demand now, when nothing is coming out, people need content, and our film is about a family dealing with the loss of a first responder. It oddly talks about trauma and grieving and how a family is affected by it and gets over it. It's definitely a drama with a lot of comedy. I think the movie's very funny, but it goes deeply into those issues. And for me, I think it's appropriate for this moment, that it's supposed to reach people now. And that really wasn't a business decision. It was more about, I think this is something that people should see. I want people to see it at this point, not in the future.
That decision means, and at least two chains, AMC and Regal, have said going forward, they're not going to show any Universal movies. Do you think we're at a point now where the whole model of how movies are going to be released in the future is changing in real time, like as we're talking?
I think that with changing technology, there's always a debate about distribution that is about how long are things out for, who gets them when, how do we cut up the pie? And I'm certainly not a part of any of those discussions. I don't think our film is really at the center of it, because we're not about collapsing the window. You know, we're either going to reach people now, or we were going to in the far distant future. They're having a different debate, which is how long should a movie be in a theater before they are allowed to release it on demand or rental or purchase. You know, for us, we're just going straight to the people because we want to. I want people to have something to see, and I'd like them to have something that they can have an emotional connection with and to laugh and get a break. And that was the key motivation here.
I spent some time with you a couple years ago when you were testing 40-Year-Old Virgin, and you allowed me to come watch a couple of test screenings, and you were trying to figure out like how the movie was playing. It was playing great. Were there any places that you could trim? And ultimately, there weren't. But you were listening so closely to the audience and how the audience reacted as this kind of organic creature in real time to the movie and how they laughed. Now, I watched King of Staten Island in my living room with my kids and my wife. So we had a group experience, but it wasn't like the group experience that you would get with, 300 strangers at the multiplex. How do you think that experience changes how a movie is received, especially a movie like King of Staten Island that has both got some very sweet moments and a lot of laughs?
Well, it's certainly not the best case scenario. Obviously, we would have loved to have had the movie in theaters. That is what we'll be doing in the future. We tested the movie a bunch of times. We've watched it with people and heard where the laughs are and did our normal work, which is collaborating with the audience. What are they understanding? What are they finding funny? That's a big part of my process. And it was really fun to hear it that way. But the whole time we were making it, I always felt like this movie works really well at home, because unlike some other movies I've made where I was just going for joke compression and how riotously funny can I make this and really trying to make the movie theater explode, this movie is much more of a dramedy. You know, it's fictional, but it's based on, an experience that Pete Davidson and his family went through, which is his father was a fireman who died on 9/11. And in the story, Pete's father is a fireman who dies in a fire, not 9/11. And even though the movie is fictional, it is about everything that comes up for the family when his mom, played by Marissa Tomei, starts dating again for the first time since his father dies and dates another fireman. And that forces Pete's character to have to face all of the grief and everything that he's probably not dealt with. And so as a filmmaking experience, it is great to share that with people, but we weren't designing it to be the explosive comedy. We were just trying to make a great movie and be true to our story.
When would you feel good going back to a movie theater or a comedy club? Do you know when that might be? And what will it take for you and maybe people like you or just general consumers to return to the way it was before? Do you think that's gone?
I think that it will return. And I think it'll be weird when it does return. There'll be a moment where we all can't believe any of this happened. So, when given the go ahead, like everybody else, I will try to return to life as it was. And, if there are new rules that we all have to follow for a while in this transition, I will follow those rules.
We're talking with writer, director, and producer Judd Apatow. One of the things that is unique to Pete and his comedy is he uses the death of his father and has in his stand-up. He was doing a roast for Justin Bieber and told a joke, "I lost my dad on 9/11, and I always regretted growing up without a dad until I met your dad, Justin. Now I'm glad mine's dead." That joke is pretty bold, but it got me thinking about this idea of like, at what point does something that's really tragic and horrible become fodder for comedy? And what's the timing? I mean, we're in an incredibly strange period in American and world history right now. At what point do people get permission to laugh and make fun and understand our situation through comedy?
I definitely think that one of Pete's survival mechanisms was to have a very dark, hilarious sense of humor about events that happened in his life. That's how he processes it. You know, he doesn't hide from it. And I think his heart is always in a really great place, even when he says the darkest possible joke about it. Like, I think that joke is a really, really funny way to talk about that. And it's definitely healing. Comedy is healing. We go right into difficult issues in comedy. There's nothing in life that can't be discussed. I think the audience knows where your heart is. And people like different types of humor. Some people like very sensitive humor. Some people like humor that's very challenging. Some people love humor that's upsetting and it makes them happy. And it's a release for them to hear jokes that are truly wrong. You know, this is a, you know, a story about, you know, a young person that had to deal with the loss of his father. And because his father was a hero, he really had a hard time feeling like he could serve, he could succeed in life. You know, it was a, you know, a strange part of Pete's childhood. His dad was someone who did something that, you know, most people don't do. He made the ultimate sacrifice to help other people. And I think there's some very specific emotional issues that come up when you are the child of somebody that does something so brave, because, you know, you do wind up, you know, left, you know, without a parent, and it is very difficult. And, you know, Pete found a way to survive by becoming an artist and being creative and writing this movie. I wrote it with him and his writing partner, Dave Cyrus. And I feel like it was a real courageous act to try to express all of his feelings about it in this film and find a way to be funny while doing it.
The Frame's John Horn talking with writer, director, producer Judd Apatow about his new film, The King of Staten Island. We have more conversation in just 60 seconds. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, kpcc.org, and on the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. We're right amidst an interview with The Frame's John Horn with Judd Apatow, the writer, director, producer. Apatow's new film, The King of Staten Island, starring Pete Davidson, is on video on demand this week. Now, Apatow isn't the only member of his family in the entertainment biz. His wife, Leslie Mann's a well-known actress. His daughter, Maude, a rising star as well. John asked Apatow about at what point he'd feel comfortable as a parent with Maude returning to work on film productions.
You know, I'm aware that the Hollywood community is trying to figure out how to keep everybody safe when they return to work. Like the rest of the country, you know, we need tests that are very accurate. And as of right now, sadly, we don't have testing in the numbers that we need. We also don't have enough information about when you're contagious, and we don't have enough information about if you can get it again if you've already had it. And those issues have to be resolved before you can put groups of people onto stages in very intimate settings.
And how would you start thinking about working yourself? Would you write stories that have smaller casts, that don't require people going on location? What would be some practical things that you're asking yourself about how you might make your next thing, a movie, TV show? What are the kinds of things that you're considering now that maybe would have been totally foreign to bring up 3 months ago?
I'm not sure. You know, I was thinking the other day, well, the Duplass brothers seem to be the two people who are built, you know, to make incredible movies with small crews and small casts in a scrappy way. They've made all sorts of amazing films, but, you know, they certainly know how to do that. And so I'm certainly open to learning how to make films on a smaller scale. And we're all seeing comedians create comedy and sketches with no one there and no one around that are oddly hilarious. So how many people can be involved and how big the crew can be, I think also requires knowing, you know, the answers to those questions about, you know, how do you know if someone's contagious? How do you know if you can catch it again if you've already had it? you know, when can we have a lot of testing? For now, I'm doing development on a lot of scripts. I'm trying to do a lot of writing so I will feel like I've been productive during this time and have some projects to offer, you know, when the go sign is given.
Whenever that might be, I'm thinking about this movie, King of Staten Island, and it obviously had been in the works for a while, and you talked about how relevant it is to today. It's a story about grieving. It's a story about reconciliation, about people getting over past losses. And I'm wondering if you think, going forward, the kinds of stories that you and other people are interested in telling will change fundamentally. Will we go toward a lot more escapism, more serious dramas? Is there a way to figure out how people are processing what we're in now creatively? I mean, what are the kinds of things that you're writing about? What's on your mind?
Well, I think a lot of us are just thinking, do we have to write about this? Is this something that is so important to everybody that it is the elephant in the room? And that is a really big question. Is this so dominating that it cannot be ignored in art? Remember, after 9/11, a lot of people wanted, you know, comfort entertainment. So suddenly they were showing Carol Burnett specials, and there was a lot of, you know, retro event comedy specials happening. And I totally understand that when you're feeling vulnerable, you do want to connect with something that brought you a lot of joy and a lot of comfort in your life. And there's definitely a part of me that thinks, man, people are going to want something really silly in the future. But at the same time, we're also going to want to deeply explore all the feelings that came up in this moment. We're all reassessing our lives, how we spend our time, what's important to us, what are the ways that we care for other people. Because one way to look at this is, it is a beautiful sacrifice. We're all doing something to help other people, to help our families, to help strangers. And it's forcing us to realize that, you know, as a world, if we don't do that, we're in trouble. We only survive because we're there for each other.
We're talking with writer, director, and producer Judd Apatow. When Staten Island premieres, it's not like you're going to have box office figures reported in the trades. And obviously there'll be some numbers, but how will people like you know if it's connecting? Because so much of how we judge a film's performance, rightly or wrongly, is based on its theatrical grosses. So is there a new way of judging how a work is connecting with an audience now?
It's always hard to know. I had a stand-up special on Netflix a year and a half ago, and sometimes you could just feel it. You could just feel that people have seen it. You know, suddenly you go to a restaurant and the waiter saw it, and someone at the next table saw it. And as you move through the world, you're having conversations about it. You're seeing people talk about it online. It is a different type of experience than sitting in a movie theater with a group of people. But you definitely have the sense of, oh, people are watching this. And for other things, you really feel it like, wow, nobody's watching this. No one is mentioning, you know, this movie to me. And other movies bubble up and you hear about them all the time. When, you know, this started happening, I really felt that people were watching a lot of those Will Ferrell, Adam McKay movies that I worked on, like Step Brothers and Talladega Nights and Anchorman. And I felt good that I was a small part of them, because I know sometimes when you're feeling bad, just seeing something really, really funny gets you through a hunk of your day. And I could sense, oh, there's a lot of people watching that. There's a lot of people talking about Superbad all of a sudden.
When you're talking to comedians, fellow filmmakers, producers, writers, what are the things that they are most worried about? Is there a common theme to what they find the most stressful and what they think and what the kinds of things that really keep them up at night?
I think the uncertainty is the most difficult part. And that's true for every business in the country. Just not being able to plan. I think if people even had any sense of here's what the next 3 months, 6 months, a year look like, they would be able to organize their minds, especially as creative people. A lot of the work is being in a solid enough space with your mental health that you can be creative and be imaginative. And, you know, that uncertainty certainly can slow you down. And you know, for a lot of people, it turns into anxiety and depression. And that's not great for creativity either. So that's probably the most difficult part. And we're all trying to trick ourselves into being in a better place to do some creative work. I know if I don't watch news after dinner time and I don't watch it first thing in the morning, I can trick myself into not thinking about what's happening, and I might be able to disappear into my imagination and create something and write some jokes. But I do have to be disciplined about tuning out for a period to get into that space.
Judd, thanks for sharing your time with us.
Absolutely. Take care.
Writer, director, producer Judd Apatow talking with the Frame host John Horn right here on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Again, Apatow's new film, The King of Staten Island, starring Pete Davidson, is out on video on demand. For all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend, and we remind you to join us Monday morning at 10 for Air Talk on KPCC.